What's up, you guys? I'm Haley.
And I'm Andrea.
And this is Inhuman, a true crime podcast. We never say that.
No, we don't. Think of other things to say, like in right. conclusion with, or not in conclusion, but like in addition to like what we say, and then right. when I sit down to record, it's like over here somewhere out of my brain.
I know,
brain.
Right? I know. Okay, I just have to, Andrea.
It's okay.
Joe Jonas just reposted my dog's video on his Instagram story.
That's so crazy.
What the heck?
This is the second time Joe Jonas has reposted something that you posted.
Yes. Okay, this isn't true crime related, but whatever. I need to talk about it. So, sorry, guys.
It just happened.
It literally just happened. I love the Jonas Brothers, and back a couple months ago, I did a video on TikTok saying, where I had texted my fiance saying, if Joe Jonas duets my video, will you come to a concert with me? So he said yes, and then Joe Jonas duetted the video. Amazing. Today, there's like a new challenge going around, and I posted a video on my dog's account of him wearing a Jonas Brothers shirt, and Joe Jonas just reposted it on his Instagram story.
Which, Mackie looks so cute in that little t-shirt.
Doesn't he? It was so cute, too, because I put it on him before I was ready to record, and he was laying down, like, sleeping when I put it on him. And he didn't even get up. He was like, cool, I like this. I'll just stay here now.
I know, the way he was standing in the video, he's just like, I don't mind this at all.
Yeah. He was looking up at me because I was holding a treat.
Oh.
The only way I could get him to actually, like, sit still.
You would never have known because he wasn't, like, smacking his lips or anything. So.
Right. Good. So, yeah. Anyway, I just needed to share that. Shortly after, Mackie jumped from the upper level of our backyard over the fence down to the bottom level of our backyard.
Oh, my gosh.
I think he's okay, but I have a video of it. I'm going to put it in my vlog because I'm vlogging today. Okay. And I'm going to put it in the vlog because it's like you can hear him hit the ground.
Like the thud. Yeah.
Yeah. It was bad. Gosh. So, anyway, how are you, Andrea?
I'm good. I'm all right. I'm hanging in there.
Yeah.
Thriving, surviving, all the things.
That's good. This has been an impossible episode to record. We have literally been trying for like a week now this episode. And it was like, at first I wasn't done with my research, so I had to push it back. And then we pushed it back for something else. And then I had to push it back again because of like stuff I had going on. And it's just been a disaster.
Yeah. But it's okay. We're still ahead of schedule, and that's all that matters. True. We're not, like, squeezing it in the day before it goes live.
Like we did with the first episode.
Yeah.
That is true.
Yeah.
Okay, so I'm very excited to cover this case. I did about a week's worth of research, on and off. I kept digging into, like, different things, so I think it's going to be a good one. I was going to make it a two-parter. I have, like, 13 pages of notes. They're 1.5 spaced. So I feel like it'll be a longer one-parter, but I don't think that there was enough. So I'd rather just like keep it in one and not make you guys have to listen to like two different episodes. So today we are going to be covering the man known as pretty much one of America's first serial killers, H.H. Holmes. And I actually was not planning on covering him this week, but I kind of discovered him like randomly. So last weekend, I was like talking to my mom about the podcast, and she was telling me about a serial killer that was in New York. She said like probably the 80s, and she couldn't remember the name. So I Googled New York hotel serial killer because that's all she could remember. And the first thing that came up was H.H. Holmes. And I'm not like exactly sure why he came up, like probably because of the word hotel.
Yeah.
But he wasn't in New York, so I don't know why he came up, but he did, and it wasn't who my mom was talking about, but I started, like, reading about him and got hooked, and I was like, okay, I need to cover this story.
Yeah.
And I had heard his name before, but I honestly, like, can't remember listening to an actual story about him, And I'm sure I probably have listened at some point, but I can't remember. So I was really excited to start digging into it. And like I said, there are a ton of details about him. So it was a lot of research, and this took place in the 1800s. So there's a lot of different accounts of things, speculations about what is true and what isn't. So through this episode, I'm doing my best to cover things that we for sure know are true. There's a lot of things that I heard in like one case or one source that I was like, okay, that sounds crazy and it could be true. But there's, you know, a lot of that I didn't include if I couldn't find it in at least two sources. A couple things I did, but for the most part, I only included what I could find in at least two sources.
Right. And at the end of the day, we're just regular people doing research on the internet. We're not investigative journalists. Sometimes we get things wrong. Sometimes we get pronunciations wrong. But, you know, we're doing the best that we can. So with the information that's out there.
Yeah, exactly. And we're always open to like you guys telling us if we like mispronounce something. Yes. Then, like, tell us because we want to learn.
Yeah, because we can admit to being wrong, especially if it's something like a victim's name or something being mispronounced. Like, we do the research and we listen to, you know, pronunciations, but sometimes those are wrong too. So,
yeah, that's true. A couple things for this case, I heard it different ways on multiple sources. So, like, even that, it's like some people just don't know. It's hard to know, especially when it's this long ago.
Yeah.
So also, like, the timeline is a little bit all over the place. So just like Andrea, if you get like lost or confused, tell me so that we don't get lost and like our listeners won't get lost. So feel free to like interrupt me and be like, wait. Like, you're off. H.H. Holmes was born Herman Webster Mudgett on May 16th, 1861. To Levi Horton Mudgett and Theodate Page Mudgett. And that's one of the things. And I Google searched it and it came up Theodate. So I think that's it.
I like it.
He had two older and two younger siblings, and the family lived in Gilmanton, New Hampshire. And they were a pretty affluent family for the time, descending from some of the first settlers in that area of America. They were Christians, and some sources say that they were very religious, while others say that the family wasn't super religious. But his father was strict and disciplined him a lot as a kid. Some reports say that his father was abusive, but that has never been officially confirmed. And if you think about it, some of the punishments given to children in the 1800s would probably be considered abusive today.
Yeah.
So I'm like honestly kind of thinking his father just was punishing him and wasn't necessarily like, you know, full on abusing him, but it could be the case too.
Right.
Holmes was known to be intelligent, but he was also allegedly bullied in school. Some people say that he was awkward and never made eye contact with others, which some people speculate that like that meant that he, you know, had some sort of personality trait that might have indicated that he was going to become a murderer. But in reality, he had a medical condition called, strabismus. I swear I looked this up too and now I can't remember. Strabismus, I think. And that's a condition where you have very little control over your eye muscles. So that's why he couldn't make eye contact. And he was bullied about this eye issue, but it wasn't anything he could control. So
that's sad. That's kind of sad.
Yeah. And it definitely didn't indicate that like something personality wise was wrong, because it was literally a physical issue.
Right.
Holmes was also bullied because some kids learned that he was afraid of the local doctor's office. And so these bullies decided to force him to go into the office and basically stare at and touch a human skeleton. And their intention was to like scare him and, you know, freak him out. But he ended up being fascinated with the skeleton. So after
you go,
this,
kids.
I know, right? So after this, he kind of started expressing interest in medicine. He allegedly practiced surgery on animals, but again, only some reports say that. I know that like animal abuse is a big indicator of like serial killers,
right?
But there wasn't like, you know, reports that were like, for sure he did this. So
okay.
There's also some reports that say he was responsible for the death of a friend as a kid. That like it was reported as an accident, and some people speculate that maybe Holmes had something to do with it, but again, it's never been proven. So on July 8th, 1878, shortly after finishing high school at 16 years old, Holmes married Clara A. Lovering. On February 3rd, 1880, about two years later, the couple had a son, Robert Lovering Mudgett, who was born in Gilmanton, New Hampshire. And I don't think Holmes was involved in his son's life a lot. And Robert actually went on to become the city manager of Orlando, Florida, until he passed away in 1953, I believe. He married a woman named Alexandra Gilbert, and they had two children. So thankfully, it doesn't seem like Robert Mudgett was affected too much by his father and his awful crimes.
That's good.
After high school, Holmes studied medicine at a small school in Vermont and later attended the University of Michigan Medical School starting September 21st, 1882. While in medical school, he got really into running scams. This was something that he started. I mean, he probably did things when he was younger, but he really got into it in medical school and he continued his entire life. While at Michigan, Holmes would steal bodies from the school lab, like bodies that had been donated for science, and he would disfigure and mutilate these bodies to the point where they were unrecognizable. Then he would go and take an insurance policy out on just a fake person, and then he would claim to insurance that this person had been accidentally killed, and since he had a body that was completely unrecognizable, insurance couldn't like say no, this isn't the person, and it allowed him to collect the insurance money.
Wow, 1800s, am I right?
I know, right? Holmes graduated from medical school in 1884 and moved to Chicago to practice pharmacy. He got a job in Chicago at a pharmacy and began using the alias Dr. Henry H. Holmes, sometimes going by H.H. Holmes, other times going by like different names like Harry Holmes or just Henry Holmes, just different stuff. But mostly he was known as H.H. Holmes. During this time, he also continued to partake in different shady businesses and real estate ventures, basically just continuing to run scams. And at this point, he was using the name H.H. Holmes for those scams. Holmes was a bigamist, which is when someone marries one person while still being legally married to another. So while he was still married to Clara Lovering, and 7 years after their son was born, Holmes married Murda Belknap in Minneapolis, Minnesota on January 28, 1887. Wow. Murda gave birth to the couple's daughter Lucy on July 7, 1889 in Englewood, Illinois. Lucy had the last name Holmes and lived in a Chicago suburb with her parents. And after Holmes married Murda, he did end up filing for divorce with his first wife, but the divorce was never finalized, so he was still technically married to both of them.
Wow.
He also did end up marrying a third woman in 1894 named Georgiana Yoke, and he was still not legally divorced from Clara or Murda. And as you'll find out, he also had a ton of other quote-unquote relationships throughout the years.
Mistresses, yeah.
Yeah, so that's it on Holmes's like background. And now we're going to kind of get into his adult life and crimes. So he was living in Chicago with his second wife, Murda, and their daughter, and he started working at a drugstore as a pharmacist. Dr. Elizabeth S. Holton, or E.S. Holton as it's in some sources, owned the drugstore, and Holmes became close with Elizabeth and her husband. Her husband was sick with cancer, and when he passed away, Elizabeth was running the pharmacy by herself. So eventually, Holmes was able to manipulate her into letting him purchase the store from the family, and he, at that point, allowed her to live in the upstairs apartment since she had nowhere else to go.
Wow. So nice.
Eventually, Elizabeth mysteriously disappeared, and Holmes claimed that she moved to California to live with relatives, and it has been speculated by many that Holmes murdered Elizabeth and possibly even her husband just to get them out of the way, but that has never been proven or confirmed, so,
okay,
you know, grain of salt, but I don't know.
Adds up, makes sense, could be possible.
Exactly. Anyway, Holmes now owned the drugstore, and then he purchased a lot across the street and began to build what was later dubbed his murder castle. He did all of the design and was constantly hiring and firing laborers, oftentimes accusing them of substandard work and then firing them without pay. So this, of course, saved him money, but it also led the construction to take about a year and a half instead of the 6 months that was expected. And it's also been said that he would circulate workers in and out to keep the design and layout secretive, ensuring that he was the only one who could fully understand the design of the castle. The castle was located on the corner of West 63rd and Wallace Streets in Chicago, Illinois, and it was 3 stories tall and reached across the entire block. It was sort of like a hotel building, but it was never advertised as a hotel, and he would get guests there by like newspaper ads specifically for rooms, not like a normal hotel.
Right. Like a, almost like a boarding house or something, like for transient people or something.
Exactly. The ground floor of the castle was the only one that was like open to the public, and it housed the drugstore that Holmes had relocated from across the street and other like local merchants. And this made the entire building look a lot less suspicious because it was just like a normal building with stores on the ground floor. Holmes also installed alarms to safeguard himself. If anyone accessed anything beyond the first floor, there would be alerts going off in his quarters, the basement, and other areas of the building so that he could be notified immediately. So this guy was smart and knew what he was doing in designing this building.
Yep.
So we're quickly going to jump up to the third floor of the castle next. The floor had a bunch of rooms that were furnished and kind of described as just nondescript. Other rooms, however, were not so normal. All of the rooms on the third floor were like super spread out among the angled and narrow hallways. And apparently there were tons of dead ends and stairways that led to nowhere, along with locked doors all over. And I don't think the third floor was ever actually fully finished. It kind of like, there's not, a, most of what happened was on the second floor. So it was kind of like, it seemed like he was trying to build another version of the second floor, which we'll talk about now, but I don't think it was ever fully finished. Now, the second floor was the most confusing part of the castle. It had 6 hallways and 51 doors leading to different rooms, but 35 of those were pretty much just normal bedrooms. The others, however, were, quote, airtight and lined with asbestos-coated steel plates or completely soundproof.
Mm-hmm.
So the rooms were crazy. They were not all the same size. Some were like the size of closets with low ceilings, and some were huge. Some of the rooms would have no doors at all, with the only entrance being through small trap doors from other rooms. There were secret passageways, hidden closets that had hidden sliding panels inside, staircases leading to nowhere. Most of the rooms had gas pipes in them that were all connected to a panel in Holmes' like quarters. And they, a lot of them also had peepholes that were rigged with alarms. So just a lot of weird stuff.
Yeah, very abnormal.
Yeah. The whole point of this was to basically disorient his quote-unquote guests, aka his victims. Holmes designed this so that anybody walking around the floor would be very confused, distressed, and would get lost pretty much right away. And his hope was that this would lead to that, it would lead them to panic, and then he could like control them more easily.
Mm-hmm.
Like I said, most of the rooms were soundproof and airtight. And as I mentioned, they, a lot of them had gas pipes that were all hooked up to a panel in Holmes's bedroom quarters. And this allowed the rooms to basically be like gas chambers where Holmes could feed any chemical into the vents through that control center in his room. And it would go like disperse into all of the rooms.
Wow.
Scary.
Sadistic. Yeah.
And then one of the most infamous parts of the castle, all around the second floor were shafts that led down to the cellar. Think like a laundry or trash chute, but not for laundry or trash, if you know what I'm implying.
For people.
yeah. Some reports say that these chutes seem to be like always greased up as well, as if to like make the sliding
Ew.
easier. So yeah. And that basement was basically Holmes' dungeon. He did most of his heinous acts down in the basement. It could only be accessed through a trap door in one of the bathrooms upstairs.
Wow, that's smart.
Yeah.
Really smart.
There were a bunch of weird contraptions and torture devices he housed down there. He would take victims down there after drugging them to torture them before he killed them. There were acid tanks, quicklime vats, a dissection table, a crematorium, and even some of Holmes' own contraptions that he had created. One of these police later compared to a medieval torture rack. He called it the elasticity determinator, and he claimed it could stretch a subject to twice their normal height.
Yeah.
Yeah. There were other like weird contraptions. It was just a lot of really creepy stuff.
Yeah, lots of torturous devices.
And before moving on, I just want to share this excerpt from a 1937 article in the Chicago Tribune that described the castle. Quote, "Oh, what a queer house it was. In all America, there was none other like it. Its chimneys stuck out where chimneys should never stick out. Its stairways ended nowhere in particular. Winding passages brought the uninitiated, with a frightful jerk, back to where they had started from. There were rooms that had no doors. There were doors that had no rooms. A mysterious house it was indeed, a crooked house, a reflex of the builder's own distorted mind. In that house occurred dark and eerie deeds." End quote. So yeah, that's the murder castle. So we're now going to get into the victims and actual crimes. And like I mentioned at the beginning, this timeline is like very messy. So I'm going to kind of stick to the timeline of like where he was, and we'll get into different victims at different points.
And there's probably victims that they don't even know about because of
Oh, 1,000%.
Certain
It's
things.
like you read my mind, because my next line is
Sorry.
about. No, you're fine. It's a good segue. This is why we work well together.
I know. Like mind reader.
Yeah. So Holmes confessed to 28 murders when he eventually got caught, but many speculate there could have been over 200 victims.
Yeah.
And a lot of this is like very gruesome. So just a little warning, especially on this first one. It's not nice if you couldn't tell by what he had in his murder
Yeah.
castle. One of the scams Holmes like ran while he was living in the murder castle in Chicago was to turn his victims' bodies into like skeleton sets to sell. He would completely skin and dissect the bodies, and then clean and polish the bones and turn them into skeletons. So he sold these to doctors and schools looking to buy them, for research and learning purposes. And his price was obviously significantly lower than other skeletons available to purchase, like legit sellers. And those buying them, they did know that this was sketchy, but at the same time, no one ever really questioned it because they were getting such a good price on them. And I think they just assumed he was like a grave robber or something like that. I don't think any of them would have ever thought that this was people he was killing.
And didn't he like claim to be a doctor at certain points? So maybe like he was like, "Oh, I'm a doctor."
Probably. I mean, he had a medical degree.
Yeah. Okay.
In 1893, Chicago was hosting the World's Fair. And this was a big deal, and because it was the celebration of the 400th anniversary of Columbus discovering America. So a ton of people were coming in to the city from all over the country. And Holmes used this as a way to target victims. So he advertised his castle as a hotel for these tourists coming in from out of town. And, at this time, people coming in to like, pretty much anywhere that they would travel, but especially an event like this, it's not like they had plans of where to stay. So, they'd be looking for
Right.
a place to stay. They would find Holmes, quote unquote, hotel when they arrived, and none of their family back home would know where they were staying, because remember, right, this is the 1800s.
No internet. You know,
phones didn't exist, and I don't think people would like write home just like on a trip, true, like this, you know, because right, it's not like they were moving. So Holmes would get them into his hotel, and then once inside, he had all the tools he needed to disorient and capture them. Another just note, many missing persons cases this long ago went largely uninvestigated, so Holmes was like able to get away with these murders, yeah, pretty easily, unfortunately. Other Murder Castle victims were women that he hired to work at his hotel. When hired as employees, they were required by Holmes to get a life insurance policy and make, wow, him the sole benefactor. So he would pay the premiums, and then it would allow him to get the insurance money if they were to die.
How convenient.
Right?
Gosh.
So I'm going to pause the little timeline here and talk about five people that are pretty much like completely assumed to be his victims. I'm not exactly sure when all of these happened or what order they happened in, so I'm going to do my best, and I'm just going to talk about it here. So first is Julia Connor and her daughter Pearl. In 1892, so this was before that World Fair, Holmes met a woman named Julia Connor. At this point, he was still married to at least Murda, his second wife, but wasn't living with her anymore. Holmes met Julia because Julia's husband, Ned Smith, was working for Holmes. Julia was around Holmes a lot because he had offered her family a place to live. So they were living with him, and Julia and Holmes began having an affair. And after a while, Ned obviously caught on, and he left Julia and their daughter to live with Holmes. So Julia and Holmes continued their relationship, and it is rumored that she ended up getting pregnant with his child. The main story told about Julia is that in September 1892, Holmes offered to perform an abortion on her, and she did not survive the operation. So that's what Holmes claims. He has never said that he murdered her. He just claims that it was like an issue with an abortion. Yeah. But, of course, many say that she was purposefully killed by Holmes, whether it be from the operation or another way. But either way, she died at his hands. And then it is, again, never proven exactly, but many believe that he poisoned her 12-year-old daughter, Pearl.
Oh, my gosh.
I know. The next victim is Emmeline Seagrand. There are a few different stories of how Holmes met Emmeline, one saying that he hired her as a stenographer through a Chicago typewriter firm, and the other saying Benjamin Peitzel, one of Holmes' accomplices who worked for him, had met Emmeline while out of town and like told Holmes about her, and so Holmes hired her. Either way, Emmeline ended up in Chicago working for Holmes. At the time, she was engaged to a man that lived in a different city, but Holmes, of course, worked his charm on her, and they began an affair. And we only have Holmes' account of what happened to Emmeline, so this is what he claimed. He said that in 1892, and again, I don't know if this is before or after Julia. It's hard to, like, there's not a lot of exact timelines.
Right.
So he said that she had become his the mistress and was an incredible secretary. So when she was planning to leave to go marry her fiance, he asked her to stay. He claimed that she was on her way to her wedding and stopped by to talk to him, and then told him that if he agreed to marry her and move to another city, she'd write to her fiance telling him she decided last minute that she couldn't be happy with him. Holmes later actually contradicted himself about this, saying that Emmeline was trapped in one of the small vaults in his murder castle, with her only escape being to write the letter. So according to him, she wrote the letter, and the letter made it very clear that it would be useless to look for her.
Wow.
And Holmes said that she then suffered a, quote, slow and lingering death.
Ugh.
So Holmes was then able to use this letter to convince Emmeline's family that she had met another man and had run off with him. And he even forged letters to the family, one in which Emmeline, quote, you know, Emmeline,
yeah,
said that this other man was a bad man and that she wanted to leave him. And I think he kind of did this to, like, cover his tracks. And at the time, there wasn't really anything that Emmeline's family could do to like prove otherwise or to find her. You know, like there's no research ability, like you can't track her down. Right. So it's really, there was not much they could do. Police later do believe that they found Emmeline's hair and bones in Holmes Castle. And an eyewitness later said that they saw Holmes and his janitor bringing out a large trunk from the house the day after she disappeared. But I only heard that from one source, so I don't know if it's true, but this was something I wanted to include. Yeah.
Yeah.
The last two women I'll talk about here were sisters, Minnie and Nanny Williams. The girl's father was a physician in Texas, and when he passed away, he left Minnie, the older daughter, money and real estate in Fort Worth. The girls were raised by family members in Texas, and Minnie ended up moving to New York to pursue an acting career. And when in New York, she actually met Holmes, who at the time was going by the alias Edward Hatch. But nothing ever happened at that point. And then at some point before 1893 or before when the World Fair was taking place, Minnie met Holmes again in Chicago, where they then became husband and wife. And that's according to a newspaper written about Minnie and Nanny at the time. So this was just another one of his schemes.
How does he pull all these like women? He's not even cute. Like he's just,
I know. I don't know. Raggy. He just had that charm.
I mean, he does have a handlebar mustache, so maybe that's like
disgusting. So Minnie, at the time when she was living with Holmes, wrote to some of her friends back in Texas, asking them that, or telling them, if you guys visit for the World Fair, you should come visit me. And Minnie's younger sister, Nanny, who had been going to school in Texas, decided to leave Texas and go to live with Minnie in June of 1893. Holmes initially claimed that Minnie murdered Nanny after getting jealous of her, and that he merely helped cover up the crime for Minnie. Oh. However, he did later confess that he murdered both girls.
Wow.
He said that he picked up Nanny from the train station when she arrived from Texas, bringing her back to the castle, stealing her money, and then pushing her into an airtight vault, locking her in to suffocate.
Ugh, what a horrible way to go. That's awful.
I know. And he said that Nanny, like, never even saw her sister. He said that he later chloroformed Minnie in her sleep and dumped her lifeless body into the basement. Wow. Holmes also claimed that he murdered Minnie and Nanny's brother, Baldwin, after taking out a life insurance policy on him in Minnie's name. He said that he poisoned Baldwin so his quote-unquote wife could collect the insurance money. That one has never been proven, but when police later searched the castle, they found both Minnie's watch chain and Nanny's garter buckle in the oven. So that was the only evidence found of these two girls, but keep in mind that they couldn't really identify the bones that were left, you know, of the ones he wasn't selling. So I feel like that's pretty damning evidence that that stuff was found in his house.
If they burnt, if he burned them, their bones would have been ash. There'd been no way to like decipher like who's what.
Exactly.
It's crazy.
Okay, so now we're going to go back to the timeline. After the 1893 World's Fair ended, Chicago's economy slumped, so Holmes decided to abandon his murder castle and focus solely on doing insurance scams. During the time he was in Chicago, he had continued running scams with an accomplice that I mentioned earlier, Benjamin Peitzel. One of the new scams that he started when he left Chicago was stealing horses from Texas and then shipping them to St. Louis and selling them and making a ton of money off of this. And this was the first thing that led him to actually get caught.
Yay! Finally!
I know, right? So this led him to jail, where he basically immediately began concocting yet another scam with his cellmate, Marion Hedgepeth. This one, Holmes planned to take out an insurance policy on himself for $10,000, then fake his own death, have Hedgepeth collect the money for him. And the deal was that he would give Hedgepeth $500 to like get a lawyer to help him get out of jail. And for reference, because I'm always curious, $10,000 is over $300,000 today. And $500 is about $3,000. So he was planning to collect $300,000 minus $3,000, basically.
Wow.
So once Holmes was released on bail, he attempted this plan, but the insurance company was suspicious and didn't end up paying out. So Holmes was obviously not thrilled, and he attempted a similar plan with Benjamin Peitzel. In this one, Peitzel was going to fake his own death so that Holmes and Peitzel's wife could collect the money. But of course, because Holmes is a monster, he ended up actually killing Peitzel and collecting the money himself. And some people believe that Peitzel could have committed suicide, but evidence later found that there had been chloroform administered on Peitzel after his death, probably to make it look like it was a suicide. And this is another thing I only heard in one place, but I could see it being true. There are some reports that Holmes doused Peitzel in chemicals, then set him on fire and watched him burn to death.
Oh my gosh.
No matter how he killed him, his plan worked, and Holmes and Peitzel's wife were able to collect the insurance money. Holmes collected $7,000 of the $10,000 payout and then gave about $1,500 to a lawyer that had helped them with the scheme and $500 to Peitzel's wife. Holmes then told Mrs. Peitzel that her husband had fled to South America, and he convinced her to let three of her five children stay in his custody to help her out.
What? No.
Because she was like in a rough spot being left alone after her husband apparently fled, she actually agreed to this. So Holmes took Alice, Nellie, and Howard Peitzel and basically started traveling all along the northern U.S. and Canada. And he kept up the ruse that they were going to see their dad. Mm. No one in the family knew that Benjamin was dead. And Holmes would even write letters to their mother from different places he, like, took them. And, you know, he would say, like, oh, we're going here. And the mom would, like, travel to that city to meet them. But then by the time they got there, he'd be like, oh, no, sorry, we, like, moved on.
Wow.
Police later found the decomposed bodies of Alice and Nellie Peitzel in Toronto. They also found teeth and bits of bone belonging to Howard Peitzel in a cottage that Holmes had rented in Indianapolis. Wow. And I'm not 100% sure exactly when they found this, but we will talk a little bit more about that in a second.
Okay.
In 1894, Holmes' former cellmate, Marion Hedgepeth, was angry that he never received the money that was promised to him by Holmes. Hedgepeth told the police about the scam they had planned and also told them about all the stuff Holmes had almost bragged about to him, telling him everything he'd done. So Hedgepeth went to the police with all this information and they immediately started searching for Holmes. On November 7th, 1894, Holmes was arrested in Boston. They were able to hold him on an outstanding warrant for the Texas horse scam. And they kept him for a while, especially after noticing that he seemed to be basically set to leave the country. He had married Georgiana Yoke, as I mentioned earlier, in 1894 before he was arrested. And it appeared to police that the two were planning to flee. I don't think there was any evidence that Georgiana like knew what he had done, but they were probably just going to like, he was probably like, we're going to move to another country. And she was like, okay, cool.
Yeah.
So Holmes was now in prison in Philadelphia, and the Chicago police started investigating his murder castle. A custodian had told them that Holmes had never allowed him to clean the top two floors, so that's when police were like, okay, we got to investigate this thing.
Yeah.
As they started searching the building, they found all the weird things he had in there, and they eventually found the basement that was filled with bodies. A lot of the bodies found were dismembered or decomposed, and they couldn't really ever determine who was there or how many bodies were actually there.
Right.
And again, a lot of the bones he had sold as skeletons, so exactly. It's really hard to know how many victims he actually had. Philadelphia police began linking up with the Toronto police after they found the bodies of Alice and Nellie Peitzel. According to Murderpedia, quote, Philadelphia detective Frank Geyer was given the task of finding out what happened to the three Peitzel children. Quote, his search for the children, like the search of Holmes Castle, received wide publicity. His eventual discovery of their remains essentially sealed Holmes' fate, at least in the public mind. So with this investigation, they started looking into the insurance he had collected on his former associate, Benjamin Peitzel. And police finally had a crime to charge him with.
Good.
Holmes was convicted of the murder of Benjamin Peitzel. And as I mentioned, he then confessed to 27 more murders. He mainly confessed to these 27, and he also confessed to 6 attempted murders in Chicago, Indianapolis, and Toronto. He mainly confessed to these because he was paid $7,500 by the Hearst papers in exchange for his confession. And again, that's like $200,000-$300,000 in today's money.
That's crazy. But he's like not even going to have access to it because he's going to go to prison.
Yep.
So stupid. That just shows how like money hungry and greedy he was.
Mm-hmm. And because of this, it's also very unclear how many, like how much of what he was saying was true, because he was always giving varying accounts of what happened. And, you know, there are estimated to be up to 230 murders. And that's based on both missing persons reports at the time and also the testimony of some of Holmes' Chicago neighbors who saw many young women enter his hotel and never leave.
Okay.
The only names that I could find that were for sure confirmed to be victims, you know, he confessed to a whole bunch, but not all of those have been confirmed. So the only ones that were confirmed were Julia Connor and her daughter Pearl, Emmeline Seagrand, and Minnie and Nanny Williams. And then this is along with Benjamin Peitzel that he was convicted for, and almost 100% likely Alice, Nellie, and Howard Peitzel.
Yeah. He was, I mean, they were in his care when they...
Exactly. Like,
duh. They should have...
Yeah.
Threw the book at him on that one.
Yeah. On May 7th, 1896, 2 years after he was arrested, Holmes was hanged at the Philadelphia County Prison. According to Murderpedia, up until Holmes died, he, quote, remained calm and amiable, showing very few signs of fear, anxiety, or depression. And this is also, like, not so nice to hear, but it also, like, was kind of something I wanted to hear, so I'm going to include it. I'm going to give a trigger warning. I don't even know what it may be a trigger of, but it's just a little gruesome, so if you want to skip ahead, like, 30 seconds, I would do that now. Holmes' neck did not snap right away when he was hanged. So he died a long, slow death, not being pronounced dead until 20 minutes after he had been hanged, which I personally think is what he deserves, justice. Which is why I said it kind of is nice.
Yeah,
like, it's gross, and like, I didn't want to know that, but also like, I kind of did.
Yeah.
A few different things happened after Holmes' death. First of all, the man who basically turned him in, Marion Hedgepeth, was pardoned for his crimes after informing police about Holmes, but he was sadly killed on December 31st, 1910 by a police officer during a holdup at a stand-up, during a holdup at a Chicago saloon. So that just made me really sad because I was like, damn, this guy like captured one of the most infamous serial killers, basically, or like led police to capture him, and he died at a like police shootout.
Maybe that was his karma because he was in prison with H.H. Holmes, so maybe he was a shitbag too and he just was trying to get off on like an easier sentence or something.
Yeah. That is true. That's a good point.
Yeah.
On March 7th, 1914, 20 years after Holmes was hanged, the former caretaker of the murder castle died by suicide. This man was named Pat Quinlan, and his relatives said that he had been haunted for several months before his death, and a Chicago Tribune article about his death said that this meant, quote, the mysteries of Holmes Castle would remain unexplained, and they pretty much did. Now, there were a lot of conspiracy theories that Holmes may have faked his death. He had requested to be buried in concrete, claiming that he was afraid that someone would dig him up and dissect him, just like he dissected his victims. And the request was granted, which led a lot of people to wonder if he maybe requested this so that he could escape and his body could never be dug up because it wouldn't be there. People believed that Holmes had bribed the guards at the prison to use a cadaver instead of him in the hanging, allowing him to flee to South America. And this was helped right along by the fact that in 1898, Robert Latimer, the janitor from the murder castle, had claimed he had seen letters proving that Holmes conned his lawyer, priest, and jail officials into burying another dead man instead of Holmes. But Latimer never produced these letters, and the story that he told about Holmes escaping to Paraguay had a lot of things wrong with it. But like all conspiracies, it still got attention and led to speculation that he was holed up somewhere in South America. So in 2016, Holmes' great grandchildren, John Richard and Cynthia Mudgett, petitioned the court to exhume his body to conduct a DNA test so they could determine if it was him or not. Guessing it was just like, there's just so much speculation about it. They were like, I just want to know, is it him or not? On March 9th, 2017, the Delaware County Court granted permission to exhume Holmes' body. His casket had been buried for 121 years deep in the ground. It was covered by 21,000 pounds of cement. There was also fear that something like tuberculosis could be trapped inside of the coffin. So there was a lot of planning that went into exhuming the body, and they had to be extremely careful. They began digging and eventually got down to the coffin when they were about 6 feet underground. So they could see the wooden coffin, and then it took 3 whole days to actually take out the coffin. So finally, they were able to get it out, and they had to saw it open, and they could finally look inside to identify him. But when they opened it, the coffin was empty.
What? I've never heard this. Okay, this is crazy.
Yeah.
What?
This obviously was a shock to many. The lead doctor that was kind of like heading up all of this, Dr. Samantha Cox, was like, oh my gosh.
What? Yeah.
So this led to a ton of meetings and conversations on okay, well, what do we do now? The whole point was to prove that whoever was buried was him, and now there's not even someone buried. At that point, they started suspecting that this possibly was a decoy coffin. So they used a sounding probe and eventually discovered that 4 inches below, something else was buried. So they really, whoever buried him, and I don't even know if it was this was something he requested or if just the cemetery that he was buried at didn't want people coming and trying to dig him up and do whatever. So they really tried to protect it, which I get it. So from this point, they literally used hand tools, using sponges to mop up the groundwater that was seeping in, and just like their own hands to chisel away at this giant concrete container. And as they kept going, they finally saw the words Mudgett and then H.H. Holmes written in black wax pencil on a wooden board sitting over the concrete. So they finally determined that this was the coffin, and they very carefully started to crack it open. They even inserted a tiny camera into the coffin, and it was described as one that's used in the medical field, whenever they have to insert a camera somewhere. And so they used that to look into the coffin to determine exactly where the body was so that they wouldn't crack it. 12 hours later, they were finally able to see, resting in the coffin, the remains of H.H. Holmes. And something kind of funny, he wasn't wearing any pants. And the archaeologists believe that possibly he soiled himself during his hanging, so they just took off his pants before burying
That makes
him.
sense. You kind of lose all your functions.
Right. And I feel like he kind of deserves that embarrassment. So,
yeah. Yeah.
They ended up having to actually drill into his skull to extract DNA to test. And they had to send it to a UK lab for testing. Like, there wasn't anywhere in the US, which is like crazy because this was 2017. Yeah. So you'd think that they'd be able to, but I don't know if like just nobody wanted to do it, or it was crazy because it wasn't like typical DNA. It was like from the bone.
Yeah.
I don't know. But they were able to match dental records from the time to Holmes, or to the skull that they had extracted. Nearly all of the molars were missing, and that was consistent with those dental records. Mm. Dr. Samantha Cox, who, like I said, was kind of the head of the whole exhumation and testing and everything, said, quote, "The best we can say at the end is that this skeleton we had in is a relation to the Mudgett family." So they couldn't ever actually say this is H.H. Holmes because they didn't have any evidence of Holmes.
Yeah.
Like, they didn't have any DNA from him, right, other than this body.
Right.
So she said that there was a connection to the Mudgett family. And I think that finally silenced all the people trying to say that he had escaped death.
Yeah. Plus, like, who would have been the one suffering for those 20 minutes if it was a cadaver, you know? Like,
right. No, I know. And I'm assuming people like witnessed it because I feel like that's the type of thing that happened in the 1800s.
They all come to watch.
And yeah. Yeah. But, you know, people with conspiracies, just that happens. Yeah. So that is the story of America's first serial killer, H.H. Holmes.
So I have to say one thing, and I'll try to make it fast. But have you heard the conspiracy that people say that H.H. Holmes is also Jack the Ripper, who is allegedly the person who murdered the Black Dahlia?
What? No, I have not heard this.
Okay. I was like, when you said conspiracies, I was like, but then you didn't say it. And I was like, ugh.
Now I'm disappointed that, like, I didn't get into that one.
So there's like a whole conspiracy, and there's like reports, again, you know, timeline 1800s, right, but that he was in England, or was it England? Yeah, England. Jack the Ripper was in England.
Right.
During the time that Jack the Ripper was, you know, doing his thing. And he was known for, like, you know, mutilating bodies.
Right.
So there's a lot of other stuff I won't go into. So you can, like, look it up yourself if you want. Okay. But there's, like, some pretty damning evidence, in my opinion. Like, I don't know for sure if he is, or, you know.
Yeah.
Because they never caught Jack the Ripper. Right. So.
Oh my gosh. Dahlia case is one that totally, like, everything I've heard about it, I'm like, oh my God, I need to know more. Maybe we'll cover that case one day and then like talk about Jack the Ripper and Holmes.
Yeah, that'd be good. Yeah.
That's really crazy. I didn't know that.
Yeah.
Wow.
another knack. Damn it. It's like finding me in here. So that's all.
Wow. I could totally see that being a thing. That's crazy. Yeah,
it is.
Oh, spooky.
I know.
Okay. So yeah, I hope you guys enjoyed that. I hope it was like clear and I was able to cover everything in a clear sense. I will post some photos on our Instagram. There's some really like gorgeous portraits of some of the women and stuff like that. And of course, of the murder castle. So yeah, you can check that out over on our Instagram @inhuman_podcast. And then I'll also post it on Twitter @inhuman_podcast. And also, guys, if you are listening, please be sure to leave us a rating on iTunes if you are listening on Apple. We have 22 ratings and we really want to get to 50 by the end of the year. And we have about at least 50 people listening, I know. So please, please, please just tap the little stars and give us however many stars, because it helps us out so much to reach more people, and we'd appreciate it so much.
We would love you long time.
Yes. So yeah, that is our case today. I hope you guys enjoyed, and we'll see you on Thursday. And until then, keep it human.